record now and hope that it works. This session has three eminent trade experts who have made an impact in the real world, as well as on Twitter. And it's a real pleasure and a slightly nerve-wracking prospect to chair this session. And thank you, Simon Usherwood, for whose idea it was, and for putting me in this position. So just to introduce the panel very briefly, Dr. Anna Jezewska is the founder and director of Trade and Borders Consultancy. It's a new consultancy. Go to tradeandborders.com to look at her website. She's a customs and international trade consultant with a combination of private sector policy and academic experience. Her main long-term clients are the UN International Trade Centre and the British Chambers of Commerce. Welcome, Anna. It's great to have you here. Dr. Dmitry Grzowinski is the lead trainer of Explain Trade, and he's a visiting professor at the University of Strathclyde School of Law. He's newly appointed executive director of the Geneva Trade Platform. Prior to launching explaintrade.com, Dmitry served as an Australian diplomat and trade negotiator at the WTO and beyond. And last but not least, Dr. David Hennig, who has identified himself here with his choice of clothing. Dr. Hennig is director of the UK Trade Policy Project at the think tank European Centre for International Political Economy. And he's the co-founder of the UK Trade Forum. And he's been recently recommended, I heard on the Today programme, by Emily Thornbury, who I'm delighted to see is present here, for the Board of Trade, in as a possibly slightly less controversial appointment than some of those who have been appointed. But prior to joining European Policy, the European Centre for International...
I'm sorry to interrupt. It's a low bar. That's all I'm saying.
No comment. Up until March 2018, David worked for the UK government, including on TTIP, and also in establishing the Department for International Trade after the referendum. And I should also introduce myself. I am a senior fellow in UK Interchanging Europe think tank, and I work on Brexit and borders in Queen's University, Belfast. So the reason we're here is because Twitter has put us in contact with one another, and Brexit has forced us into closely following the work of our panel. And the way I just propose to do this is going to be, we'll do what we can in terms of trying to have a conversation as informally and as possibly informatively as possible through using this means. So I have a few questions that I've pre-warned our panelists about, and then we will hopefully work into some discussion, and then please feel free to ask a question either using the chat function or by raising your hand. If you can raise your hand using that particular function too, we'll try and come around to you. So to begin with, Anna, maybe if I can start with you, it's a basic question. It's basically, what got you started on Twitter? And what or who made you realize that it's potential in terms of sharing trade expertise?
Thank you. And first of all, thank you for having me. I'm ashamed I don't have an appropriate t-shirt. And I'm definitely going to order one of that says trade expert in big pink letters. I think that's amazing. Who got me started on Twitter? I was initially quite reluctant to join Twitter just because of the kind of time investment necessary. I used to be on LinkedIn, and I really like LinkedIn because with LinkedIn you can check it once a day and you didn't really miss much. With Twitter, that's not necessarily the case. And the answer to the question, who got me into Twitter, is very simple, and it's David. It was a bit unexpected, but basically about 2.5 years ago in February 2018, and I checked that today, we all went as a group to kind of a trade panel with one of our favorite trade experts presenting. And after that panel, we found ourselves in a pub in central London. It was David, myself, and two other prominent Twitter experts. And I believe David said, you cannot be a trade expert and not be on Twitter. Or I'm not entirely sure, it might have also been, you can't do trade and not be on Twitter. But I thought David's probably right. And as far as I remember, I signed up for Twitter the same night after coming back from the pub. So it's all David. David, you unmuted yourself. Do you want to comment right now?
Well, the drink was talking, presumably. I mean, I think this is most unfair. Anyway, we'll just put another one down because I got started on Twitter because the government told me to do so. So, therefore, we can put both you and I, who are both very popular with the UK government, down to the UK government telling me to do so. And that is actually true, because in 2014, when working on TTIP, we had a big push in the UK government to do digital comms, and we should all go out there and be friendly. And one of the ways to do it was by setting yourself up on social media. I thought this is not a good idea. But then what pushed me into it was that Department at the time, Business, Innovation and Skills, I think we were called, had a three-week IT outage when we changed IT suppliers, and the entire IT failed for about 3 weeks. And the only thing that worked was the internet. So I thought, well, what can I do that's useful? And I thought, well, let's try this Twitter thing. And it sort of went from there to the point when evidently a couple of years, 4 years later, apparently was saying you can't be in trade without doing it. I mean, that's probably true. But
to be clear, I wasn't complaining. I was giving you credit. That was just that.
What I'd be clear about is that, we are now, but amateurs, because fortunately one of our number is, as far as I can tell, the most followed trade expert on Twitter globally. Aren't you, Dimitri?
I'm pretty sure more people follow Tony Abbott than me, so I'm second at best.
Ouch. Ouch.
let me also just, while I have the mic, quickly correct you, Katie. You awarded me a PhD in that introduction that I certainly do not have. Thankfully, I think Anna has about 6, and she's very generous, so wouldn't mind sharing. So I can be a doctor by osmosis for this session, but I am certainly no doctor, medical like Liam Fox or academic like Dr. Jezuska.
Yeah, and we call you Professor Grosabinski.
No, actually, Professor Paul is on this call. And when I was awarded my visiting professorship at Strathclyde, within a minute, I received a follow-up message from Paul saying, this under no circumstances allows you to put professor in front of your name anywhere, including in bars. Which, I mean, talk about wanting to make policy U-turns. I immediately reconsidered the whole affair, but by that point, the paperwork was in. So.
How did you get started on Twitter, Dimitri?
Honestly, I wasn't allowed to be on Twitter when I was in the civil service. Unlike the UK government, the Australian government, at least at the time, took a particularly dim view to civil servants freelancing on the interwebs. And then once I got out of it, I just sort of dipped my toe in the water, and no one believes me when I tell them this now, but I was completely disinterested in Brexit. It was never something I'd worked on. It was never on my radar. I was an Australian in Switzerland. So I was kind of engaging with the trade war stuff, with the US-China stuff. That's what I found interesting. And I was kind of adding like my little 2 cents here and there and mostly just looking for good jokes. And then I kind of just stumbled into it because people kept saying dangerous things about stuff I knew about.
That's a good enough incentive. So do you think there's something in particular then about trade itself that kind of lends itself to expertise coming in and maybe correcting, misrepresentation or, being useful? Dimitri?
Sorry, you ended that with being useful, so I automatically turned to Anna rather than me.
Do you think it's Brexit or is it trade?
I think Brexit's a weird situation where something that is incredibly technical and incredibly detailed heavy and that normally happens completely below the radar. Like international trade is a lot of hard people working, but you mostly don't see it. Stuff just turns up at warehouses. It gets across borders. You can buy things. There's a small group of people that work really hard, but mostly it's just kind of in the background. And then suddenly this very complex, very technical thing was thrust into the center of the public debate for, I guess, 4 straight years now. That lent itself to a lot of people coming on board to basically try to bridge the gap between that technical insular world and the front pages of newspapers. So that, to that extent, but it could have really happened to anything. Were the biggest challenge from Brexit plumbing related, you would right now be sitting in front of 4 plumbing experts basically explaining how they became Twitter famous for explaining how toilets flush. Like it does, it can be anything, but in this case it was trade.
Okay. Do you, David?
No, I'm not sure. I think there is something about trade because trade is kind of all embracing. Everything can be in trade. And what we do in our trade agreements is we take things that are understandable, like buying and selling products, and we turn them into total gobbledygook in terms of legal treaties, or rather, you know, I didn't because TTIP failed, but Dimitri had more success than I did. So we turn them into these highly technical chapters, technical barriers to trade or sanitary and phytosanitary, which don't obviously have much to do with the real trade as is practiced. And then we get to explain what they actually all mean. So I think there is something about trade. It's simultaneously as one of the founders of Trade Twitter a long time before my time told me, say, you know, it's brilliant. He said that trade is that covers everything and nothing ever happens. Well, that was in the days of Doha rounds of the WTO when really nothing happened and it was never in the news. Now nothing happens, but it's in the news a lot and people yell about it a lot. But yeah, I think there is, and it's a great challenge to try to explain in 300 characters or a few tweets of 300 characters what technical barriers to trade are. I mean, or Anna's stuff. I mean, I still read all of Anna's tweets, but I still don't really understand what happens at the border. And in fact, most people don't understand what happens at the border, including, I think, many of the people who are claimed to be, if you had one of these that said customs experts, there's a number of those who don't seem to know very much about what happens at the border. But Anna, fortunately, does.
Anna, do you want to tell us what happens at the border? No, I'm only joking.
A lot of exciting stuff happens at the border. You need to follow me to find out. It's a shameless plug. I would agree with what David said and both David and Dimitri. I think there is definitely something about trade, as in trade is so many different things and no one can possibly know all of it. We have, you know, within our little trade community, we have obviously customs people, we have trade people, legal experts, lawyers, we have trade policy experts, we have experts in SPS, TBTs, on all different areas. So I think one of the amazing things about Twitter is that you have one place where all these experts in their little different areas kind of come and talk about what they know and what they've been working on for a long time. So I think in that respect, trade is definitely something that lends itself very well to a social media platform. On the other hand, I would agree that the interest that we're seeing now is definitely due to Brexit. And I definitely wouldn't call myself Twitter famous. I think these guys are. I'm enjoying being here on this panel, but I'm not necessarily in the same league. But I do have to say that I've been doing this for a really long time. And I remember back in the day when I did my PhD, no one wanted to talk to me about what I did. Literally no one. My own family didn't know what I was studying or researching, and they really didn't care. And when I was working as a consultant at the Big Four, we tried to get our clients excited about rules of origin, customs, borders, trade facilitation, and it was a struggle. No one cared, even though we were trying to save them money. And now we have journalists literally calling us to talk to us about rules of origin or other aspects of trade. And that's all Brexit. That's really nothing to do with me or or anything like that. That's just Brexit and the interest that's there for something that, as David pointed out and Dimitri pointed out, it's very technical. It was never meant for you know, front pages of any newspaper, and yet here we are.
My family still don't really know want to know what I do. The more they learn about it, Dimitri nearly gave the game away on Twitter once. I do remember this tweet. He said, "We're only one Google search ahead of you." We all sat on him and sent him private message and say, "Never say that ever again."
That's why we're all on Twitter, because our family and our loved ones don't want to talk to us about Brexit or trade anymore, and we need to find other people to talk to.
This is true. The family ran away. Yeah.
So if people are trying to up their Twitter game, either to have some company and people to listen to their thoughts, or simply to try and, or to be useful, as Dimitri would like to be, what's your top tip, David?
So I think my top tip for doing it is that if you're going to do it, I think you've got to go in pretty wholeheartedly into Twitter, and I think you've got to do it regularly and see it as a big part of your job. So I've, in the last couple of years, particularly while I've been in the think tank world, I've always seen this as a network of experts, like Anna was just saying. I can find the people, I can test some thinking. The first point of testing some thinking on something I'm writing might be that I'll try and tweet it and see if it gets any reaction at all, whether it makes any kind of sense. Can I even explain what I'm doing in 300 characters? But then there will be other experts. I will learn stuff. But yeah, it's very much about putting a lot in. I mean, I think that if I only check Twitter twice a day, to be honest, it wouldn't be enough. I'd not pick up all the things I want to pick up. So I try to put it into a sort of into a schedule. It's basically, it should, in theory, when I started, it's all the bits of in between time. When you finish an email and you're not quite sure what to do next, you have a quick glance at Twitter, what's happening. But yeah, very definitely, it's do it more often than once a day or something like that. I suppose the other thing I do is I don't actually follow that many people. Steve Pears, who's not on this call, who's another of the sort of, you know, Twitter pioneers, as far as I can see, appears to follow 85,000 people or something. I'm like, I have no idea how he actually sees what's going on. Unless, I mean, he may have a brain that sort of, you know, processes 30,000 tweets a minute or something. I don't. 800, that's quite enough.
That's a good tip. Professor? Dimitri?
I mean, that's a good one right there. Just invent fake titles to seem more authoritative in your tweets. But that one's for free. My best piece of advice is probably to send out tweets that you would want to read, especially if you weren't an expert in your own field. Every tweet I send that's not just like a throwaway joke or a niche joke between my friends and I basically ask myself that if I cared about this but had 15 seconds and only cursory knowledge, what is in every single tweet in this thread, what is the one key piece of information that I would want to take away? What is an analogy that resonates with me? What in my life can this be compared to that I would go, right, okay, I may not understand the full technical intricacies of this, but I don't have to. I understand how this could be a problem, or I understand how this could work the way it does, or I have seen an immediate parallel. If you do that and you basically talk about, you know, I'm a hopeless, hopeless, hopeless geek, as everybody who follows me knows. And so I forever am plugging my obsession of Dungeons and Dragons into this. And often when I hear other players who love the game explain it, I listen to them and I cringe because they're explaining what's kind of, they immediately go into the technical details or they obsess over some minor thing. And they don't stop and ask themselves, okay, if you've never heard of Dungeons and Dragons or you've heard about it once, you've never played, what would resonate? How can I explain this to you in a way that you get why I love this? And it's the exact same thing with trades, the exact same thing with anything. Find what makes it resonate with other people and then make sure your content reflects that to the best of your ability. And then make fun of David Henning, because that resonates with everyone. There is a universal audience from that, from like the top of Westminster down into the local pub. That is what brings us together as people.
David. You make it sound like quite hard work, Dimitri. Is that something, is that the sort of the hidden kind of, is that the secret to Twitter actually, that it's actually quite hard work if you're doing it right?
I think it's like a lot of other things, and please, David, Anna, jump in. I think, firstly, the more you do it, the less you have to work on each individual tweet. The more experience you have basically just crafting tweets and seeing what resonates and what doesn't, the less you have to sit there staring at the tweet compiler, like working out how to move words around to get it down to 280, working how to get the concepts right. So there is a bit of that, and there's sort of some people take to it naturally more than others. I was lucky in the civil service, in the diplomatic corps, we have to communicate really, really briefly because our cables have tight limits. So I basically had years of training and experience being like, I just thought there was a 7-hour meeting. My minister's going to read two lines. How do I convince them? How do I tell them all of that information in two sentences? So I had a head start, and that's what I try to use those skills. But yeah, look, I think especially when you're starting out and you're kind of, it is, you know, it's a skill. Otherwise, it's a skill and it's effort. Otherwise, everybody would do it.
Yeah, and it's definitely a skill. I sometimes wonder, and then I stop myself from doing this, who are all these people who are following me? And, you know, what is it that they're looking for? And I have to stop that because that's actually too much. I almost need to do it on instinct. Whatever it is they're following me for, I shouldn't actually not think about that. It's not a one-on-one conversation almost. It's like I've still got to be whatever it was I'm doing. So I guess that sort of fits in as well.
I think I have a slightly different perspective on this, which is probably why I'm not nearly as good on Twitter as Dimitri and David, and that would probably explain a lot. But my key advice would be think about why you're on Twitter. As Dimitri pointed out, and I think that's the reality of it, it's a massive time investment. Not everyone can be on Twitter. I think that's one of the things that keeps surprising me in terms of the fact that people don't realize that a lot of people just can't tweet. I wouldn't be able to say 90% of what I'm saying on Twitter if I was still in my previous full-time employment. And there are so many, I have so many colleagues in both trade and customs that cannot tweet, or they're very restricted when they tweet. And it might be just because, it's about Brexit. And even though it's not necessarily, what I say is not necessarily hopefully controversial or pretty political or anything like that, but it's still about Brexit, and Brexit is a sensitive topic. There are a lot of people that are worried about what they might be putting out there. There are cases where you have one designated person within a company that is the person that will tweet. And if you're not that person, you're not allowed to. So, you're not necessarily always allowed to tweet. The other thing is, bear in mind, and I know this is not a popular statement, but bear in mind that being on Twitter and having a profile can make you unemployable for certain jobs. And that's something that I definitely came across, that some people say that, okay, if we were to work with you, you will need to stop tweeting. So obviously you don't want to spend, bear in mind how much time you're investing in something that you might need to one day stop altogether. And some people even say that, given your Twitter profile already, and again, I don't have a massive following compared to these incredible guys, that already makes me unemployable for them. Now, that is only a couple of jobs, some jobs, but make sure that the jobs you're after aren't the ones that will find it a problem. I think for me, if I can share a quick story, I remember back in 2018, at the beginning of 2018, I was talking to a colleague who I used to work with on free trade agreements way before this whole thing happened, before the referendum, and we haven't spoken for many years, and we were catching up, and I was still very new to being in the media, very new to being, quoted in newspapers, and I was having a bit of a moment. I was a little bit excited about this whole being visible thing, and I was going on and saying, you might have seen my name here, and I've done this and this. Sounds having a bit of a moment, and she was like, oh yeah, all right, fine. And then she said to and I asked her what you've been doing, and she said, oh, I just completed a project for McKinsey, and I've done this and I've done this. And that made me realize that while I'm spending my time on Twitter, There are people who are consistently getting fantastic projects and fantastic work. And one thing that's very clear for me is that while being on Twitter is a learning experience, I won't necessarily learn a lot, like new technical skills. I mean, I learn about trade by doing, and I think we all do. If it wasn't, you know, obviously you can hire Dimitri and then he'll tell you everything he knows about trade and you're all good. But unless you're lucky enough to have Dimitri as a teacher, you know, you learn by doing, whether you're a lawyer, whether you're a trade policy person, whether you're a writer, a journalist, you learn trade by doing. And at the moment, there are so many incredible opportunities when it comes to trade in terms of projects. So my key piece of advice would be make sure the time you spend on Twitter is aligned with where you want to get to. So for me, I know I can't be on Twitter. And David's absolutely right. In order to do it well, you can't just be on Twitter twice a day, which is what I do. And this is probably what I'm going to be doing until the end of the year, because I just don't see any other option. But yeah, make sure that where you want to be, the types of projects you want to do, the types of work you want to do is aligned with how much time you're spending on Twitter. At the end of the day, this is no one's full-time job. Make sure you know what you want to be known for, what you want to do, and that this investment is for a good reason. It's a worthwhile investment. It's just, it is an investment. And to do it well, you really have to invest.
I think it does help you to get, no, I mean, yes, it probably helps you to get jobs and not get jobs. I think both ways around. So it's not just the negative. I also think that this particular UK government, and not, it's not just this government in the UK, friends in the US say the same thing, is particularly averse to any alternate viewpoint. I'd have been starting tweeting now. I don't see any sign that serving civil servants now are being encouraged to do so. A previous government had a very different view and was a lot more open to things. I like to hope that future governments will. I imagine the style of a Biden administration would be very different to the style of a Trump administration. So yes, I think you've got to be true to yourself, as Anna sort of said. You've got to think about, well, is, you know, yes, it could damage me, but equally, times come and go, and that can't be, you know, it's also about personal satisfaction as well. And you know, as long as you're being true to yourself and you're not actually being someone completely different and obnoxious online, and you know, I hope you're not. I don't think anyone would be, particularly if they're using their own name. A few who do. Then just go for it. And yes, you'll gain some stuff, and you may lose some stuff out of it right now.
Is your Twitter persona an accurate representation of who you are, David?
Oh, it's probably about 70%, perhaps. There are some things I don't put on Twitter. So I don't put on anything about, I don't say what party I am, which has led a number of people to say, therefore you must be Liberal Democrat. I've no idea how you get to that, but that is has literally happened several times. I've also never actually said whether I was Remain or Brexiteer, which actually means both sides always tell me that I'm the other one. And I had I think it was a Conservative MEP or former MEP sort of booming across a room in a party in Brussels going, I know you're a Leaver, but you're a sensible one. I thought, thanks, that's just what you want, you know, a room full of people in Brussels to hear. So I don't do that. There's some stuff that I just think that actually, because I want to be, doing trade from whatever angle, whoever's right or wrong, that sort of stuff I won't do. I do put some of the personal stuff in, like Dimitri's Dungeons and Dragons. I'll put in a bit of football or cricket or the weather or whatever. And it's definitely not somebody completely different. But it's not me. It's not completely fully me either. Oh yes, I'm reminding myself. I was also accused once of one of my favourite insults. I was accused of being a DUP. This is particularly pertinent in Northern Ireland. DUP ultra Brexiteer traitor. That's a fine moment for me. But yeah, but I always reckon it's a lot of me. Oh, and I don't usually put anything. I mean, some people do family stuff. I don't really put any family stuff on there either. So, you know, I've chosen the sort of the borders within which I will I'll tweet.
My most retweeted tweet was a comment from my youngest daughter, which she always reminds me of. It was quite sweet. Dimitri, what about you in terms of your persona, Twitter persona, and maybe what that allows you to tweet and maybe decide against tweeting?
So I'm more confrontational on Twitter than I am in real life, generally. I'm not actually, absolutely no one, including anybody on this panel will believe me, but I don't like confrontation. I don't particularly like arguments or debates in real life. That's not my jam. As I was kind of alluding to before, the reason I get into the occasional Twitter kerfuffle is that it's your mate Barry from the pub being wrong about how borders work is a minor irritation that may be taken collectively with a million other people who are wrong, has some impact. Somebody with an audience in the hundreds of thousands being wrong about how borders work in the context of a public policy discussion is actively dangerous. Actively dangerous to people with real businesses and real lives who make decisions about how they should not just vote, but how they should prepare, how they should structure their businesses, who they should reach out to based on what they hear on Twitter. And so to the extent that the stakes for being wrong with a large audience, whether it's on Twitter, in a newspaper, are exponentially higher. And so to that extent, I am more confrontational on Twitter than I would be in real life, because in real life, like, you're wrong. I disagree with you. I can try to explain it, but it doesn't. At the end of the day, kind of the most important thing is that we get along. On Twitter, this stuff really, really matters, and can be really dangerous. And so I'm more actively confrontational there. What I don't always live up to this, but I try to live by one golden Twitter rule, which is do not punch down. I am religious about, I have some of the stupidest things said to me in my replies that you can possibly imagine, consistently and thoroughly, and I'm reasonably good at mocking people. So I would, you know, there are times when I'm like, this is a softball over the plate. I can, 2,500 people at least would greatly enjoy how I could dunk on this. But I think quote tweeting somebody with 82 followers from an account like my size is bullying. I think if you have a prominent following, if you have tens of thousands of followers, if you are a newspaper columnist or a politician, you, because of the weight of your words, you have stepped into the public square, and therefore it is legitimate for even an account like mine, an account much larger than mine, to say you are wrong and you are a bit silly, and here is all the reasons why, and here is a GIF of like SpongeBob SquarePants laughing at you. That is fair game. But those, for example, I don't think I have ever, to my knowledge, criticized the UK civil service, because they are simply not allowed to tweet back at me. They literally cannot get on and even explain themselves, let alone call me a jerk back. Or secondly, to small accounts, in part, and I think this is the other part of Twitter. You know, David was saying he doesn't know who the 50,000 odd people following him are. I don't know who the 55,000 people or whoever many I have following me are, but what I do know is that not all of them comport themselves universally with kindness, empathy, and restraint. And so I'm really conscious of the fact that if I highlight an account, especially a small account, that account often then receives dozens and dozens and dozens of tweets of abuse, and some of it's personal and cruel. So that's my one Twitter rule. I hope I don't punch down in real life either, but on Twitter, it's something I'm hyper-conscious by, and I cannot recommend it enough to anybody else who's considering getting it into the game. It just helps you sleep better at night.
That's good advice. Thanks, Dimitri. Anna, do you have some comments on that?
About Twitter persona, I have no idea how I come across. I think I'll be the last person to know. I did make some decisions early on. This is not, you know, Anna's take on all things trade, Brexit, politics, and so on. I tweet on, about certain topics, and this is because I do treat this as a kind of professional account in a way. As a consultant, I'm very mindful of who my clients are. Since I work a lot with different governments, international organizations, and institutions, I tweet, but I'm also very mindful of what I tweet. So there are certain things I don't touch, anything to do with politics. I mean, I will comment, but on things related to Brexit, but I am very, very mindful of topics that I cover. And equally, I don't cover everything. So when there's an A-levels scandal, that's not necessarily something that, it's not that I don't have an opinion on that, but that's an opinion I will share with my friends, not necessarily go on Twitter for that. And that's, again, that's just because of, I just don't have that kind of time to be on Twitter that much to cover everything. So I try to narrow it down. And then as David said, add some topics that make me a little bit more human. But equally, I'm very private on Twitter, so I wouldn't mention family or stuff like that that I'm not happy sharing. So, to be honest, I have no idea how I come across. I also try a lot of things on Twitter. I see how people do certain things on Twitter, and I just look at it and wonder, maybe I could do something similar. And I think that's to do with also Twitter being, and I think Dimitri said this, it's also an interesting exercise in the way you communicate and you kind of convey your knowledge and experience. And that's something, you know, Dimitri is incredible when it comes to that. And I've learned so much from reading Dimitri's tweets and David's as well. And that's something that doesn't necessarily come naturally to me, just being able to kind of take everything and put it into one tweet. So I think I'm using Twitter a lot as kind of experimental platform to see whether I am able to communicate better or not.
Do you have an example of like a tweet or a thread that you're quite pleased about? Doesn't necessarily have to be your most tweeted one, but ones that you sort of thought, that's a good example of using expertise well.
I think the tweets that I like, no one likes. And the tweets that I, you know, the tweets that I like are the tweets when I go all kind of in with my academic hat and talk about the complexity of customs and how this and this and this. And the tweets that people respond to are the tweets where I read an article and say, wait, this is completely wrong. Let me debunk this. And I just go and just kind of debunk an article. And that's where when people respond. I think there's a lot of kind of, there's a preference for kind of, in a way, a singularity on Twitter, as in like people like when tweets are very clear and have one point. And by just naturally, I'm the kind of person that kind of sees two sides to everything. So it's very difficult for me to be so kind of clear and present the trade-offs of trade on Twitter very well. I recently noticed, well, it wasn't that recently, but Dimitri was doing something nice where he was saying these two things can be true in a tweet. And I found this was a very nice way to put it, because one thing that we're all trying, all of us and everyone else who's on part of trade Twitter, that we're all trying to convey is how there are trade-offs to things. It's not that simple. If it were that simple, that, you know, that wouldn't be a problem. But it's, you know, there are different trade-offs and we're trying to explain that. And that's necessarily not something that lends itself very well to Twitter. So yeah, I don't know. I think the tweets that I like are incredibly unpopular, and the tweets where I'm just upset about something I've read, that these are the ones that get a lot of likes and retweets.
Anna is too modest. I'm getting getting a little, you know, I need to put in a word to the other way of this, because I remember someone, another of the trade community saying at this point when Anna was doing more on Twitter of saying, you know, this is a real blow for trade Twitter, that Anna coming on board, because it means we can no longer steal what she thinks and pass it off as our own ideas. So, you know, I think that's you know, and that's kind of true. So, you know, far too modest. I don't know whether that's just Anna personally or whether there's some kind of, you know, male female difference whereby, you know, we like, this allegedly is true that men think that they run the world anyway, so everybody should be interested in our thoughts, but I've no idea whether that is the case or not.
The imposter syndrome, a very yes. Typical female, yes, definitely the case.
So, not your UAC's panel persona.
imposter syndrome, because my tweets that I was I was pleased it went down very well, but I spent the most time ever thinking about was, I did something last year. I did a whole long thread on Ireland. It was, and I was really worried about it. It was kind of a Brit tries to explain Ireland and what the Irish protocol and the different communities and whatever. And pretty much the only thread I ever written in advance, rewritten, wrote, you know, then posted it, thought, well, you know, this could be the end of my career, really, because if I get this wrong, I've got Ireland wrong. And let's face it, most people in London have no idea about Ireland. It went, thankfully, it went down well, and, you know, in both in Ireland and in London. So it paid off, but I did feel I was outside of my comfort zone. But that was partly why I did it. I thought, well, I'm outside my comfort zone here. I'm not fully understanding it. I'm going to try and explain it in a way that I think is going to be helpful for others as well. And that worked. But yeah, that was slightly nerve-wracking. It may all look like it's all very pristine and we think we can do everything here, but no, that was worrying. I was pleased it came off.
I remember that thread well, and when I saw it, my heart was slightly in my mouth on your behalf, but it was really excellent. You did it very well. Yeah.
Well, that's why I did not want to have that done as you went along. And, oh, I've just thought of something else. It was, yeah, it's not one to improvise.
No, definitely not. Dimitri, anything you're particularly proud of?
Well, I mean, obviously, my tweets are like my children, so each and every one of them is a blessed gift to the world. But specifically, there was a thread I did maybe a year ago or something, where I basically went through and explained how trade negotiators approach trade and services in an agreement, which is like the most technical, like fiddly area of trade policy imaginable. It's by far the most complex. And it did like weirdly well. And by far the most common reaction was, this shouldn't be interesting, but it kind of is. You know, like up on like, you know, no opinions blog and things. And it sort of got like a lot more traction than what was incredibly nerdy explanation of trade and services really deserved. I mean, more people saw that tweet than on earth should actually understand trade and services. Like, not that many people on earth need to understand services listing that saw that tweet. So I know for me, that was like, okay, this worked. Like I was able to put together something that people seemed to resonate in an area that when somebody asked me to explain it in real life, I'm just going like, okay, sit down, brace yourself, get a strong drink. You know, tell your parents you'll be late for dinner because this is going to be 3 hours of our lives.
I have a question here from David Roberts that is kind of related. And it's a big question. We'll just come out with it. So in what do you think your tweeting has influenced policy or maybe anything significant in any way? It's not meant to be a sarky question. He actually put it very well. I'm just summarizing here. But is there a policy impact, I guess, or consequence of your tweeting, do you think?
So, I mean, first, obviously not. No, the thing that I am sort of proud of, and obviously you can never measure causality with policy ever. But when I started tweeting about anything but about Brexit, this was 2018, sort of, no, maybe 2017, 18. And all of the articles in the newspapers was basically articles saying that the World Trade Organization rules means that Brexit will have no noticeable effects on trade with the EU. The EU will be obliged to continue extending to UK trucks, goods, consignments, whatever, the same treatment as it does when the UK is within the single market and customs union. That sounds like an insane thing to vocalize now in 2020, as the UK government is like parachuting in lorry parks and preparing emergency stockpiles and mobilizing troops. But that was the conversation back then. And it wasn't a fringe conversation. It was in the front, it was in the comment sections and the front pages of major, major newspapers that to a large extent, I think, dictate UK policy. And a group of us, pushed back on that incredibly hard. The first tweet I ever had go truly viral was basically taking apart an article by a UK professor, basically arguing that very point and explaining why that is not the case. This is not an argument you hear anymore ever. Even the economists for free trade have stopped including it as an asterisk to explain why their modeling of the downsides of leaving the EU is zero. Like, even they no longer roll this out. And I am proud of that, because if a single business saw my tweets or saw this and went, okay, I actually need to prepare for this, then that's one business that will be more ready, and that's potentially some workers. But I think, you know, to the extent a whole bunch of us, and also to some extent, you know, reality, help turn the Titanic 2 degrees on that one. And for me, that was like my number one objective. I have never publicly expressed a view on whether the UK should leave the European Union. I guess it's all academic now. What I've always said is, what I'm trying to contribute is, firstly, I will be honest about the trade consequences. And second, it's important to me that the UK public understand what this is about to be. And I think the conversation is far, far more informed now, though still nowhere near where it should be. If you want to test that theory, go to any thread about the end of the transition period and see how many people are still confusing the consequences of not getting a free trade agreement with the consequences of transition ending. The conversation is still not where it should be, but it has gone a heck of a long way since we got into this game. And so I'm proud of that. I don't know if that was, maybe I had nothing to do with it, but I like to think maybe I contributed 0.25%.
Thanks, Dimitri. David?
Well, I mean, what comes to mind immediately is that if one looks at the 20 or so Conservative MPs who lost the whip last year of voting the wrong way or whatever vote it was, a rather high percentage of them seem to be following me on Twitter. So I'm not sure that they would think that was necessarily a good thing. The same has actually applied to, ministers. I think I had Julian Smith, one or two other ministers following me. None of them are still ministers. So I think that there is, there's definitely a link there between reading about trade and, not being in government anymore. There was actually a period last June, July, August, particularly, I think, when it was more uncertain which way things were going to go between June and September, say last year, it was pretty clear to me that actually some of the folk around Johnson, Cummings, whoever it was, were actually following some of the trade people on Twitter, because there was some of the stuff was going on, like, they weren't talking to the EU, and then suddenly somebody would say, "You're not talking to the EU. Why are you not doing this?" Suddenly, the following day, there'd be a statement saying. Yeah, we've decided we're going to go and talk to the EU. Now, that doesn't happen anymore, I've noted. But there was a small period where it seemed like somebody was kind of keeping a track on us of what we were saying. Again, I'm not sure that that's necessarily a positive political outcome. Like Dimitri said, in general, I think that the level of knowledge has gone up, and I think as well for some journalists who take the time to read into this, and some MPs and whatever. What I do think we've had the impact of is that the three of us and many others as well are seen as relatively trusted sources. So if there is a dispute or something breaks out, and this is kind of an extension of what Dimitri was saying, the people will say, okay, well, does David say the same thing? Does Anna say the same thing? Does Sam Lowe say the same thing? And I think that is actually that is a good thing to be able to present an almost immediately available source of people who are, we are not going to use whatever it happens we happen to think to make a point about trade, because frankly that would kill my career stone dead straight away, and I suspect everyone else's. It was the worst thing I could do is basically lie about what trade regulations said in order to, because I really want to leave the EU with a deal, no deal, whatever it is. And so having that trusted status, I've had journalists, too many journalists come and say, is this right? Is that right? So it probably does make a positive impact But given where we are today and given the news out there, it would be we'd be hard pushed to say that we were making a really, you know, we'd made all the difference to the UK Brexit debate. It's not entirely evident that we've done so, sadly.
You tried anyway. Anna?
The short answer to this question is no. I have no delusions of grandeur that my tweets have in any way changed anything or in terms of policymaking. The one thing that I'm personally quite proud of is that I was I spoke to BEIS about a month after the referendum about extended accumulation, which is what the UK is now proposing. And personally, that makes me very happy. And that's my own little personal win and something to be proud of. But in terms of tweeting, I think I don't think that was ever my goal to influence policymaking. Again, I don't have that kind of impact. But what I do try to do, and it's there's a lot of former customs officers, logistics people, and so on, is to explain customs to people. Customs is an area of tax. By definition, tax is not something for public consumption. You wouldn't have, it's a technical area. It's a highly technical area. And I think one of the reasons, when I got on Twitter, one of the reasons that I stayed and decided to spend what is basically my free time tweeting about Brexit is because I saw what people were saying about customs, people who were either in trade or even weren't, and assumed that because they read something about trade at some point, they can comment on customs. And the amount of confusion, and I think that's the same for everyone. You see people genuinely needing a bit of advice as to what are these strange things that they're hearing about? What are tariffs? What is a free trade agreement? What is the customs union? And if you Google that, you'll come to very technical, dry sources that will explain this to you in a way that you won't even understand trying to read the explanation. So I think there was a massive need to explain customs to people in a way that's hopefully simple, approachable, and not so dry. And I think, and again, that wasn't just me, there's a big group of people that do that. But I think, I hope that one thing that happened over the last 4 years on Twitter, or the last 2 years that I was on Twitter, is that you can't make a claim about a customs procedure and say this will solve the issue of Brexit or borders or whatever without people pushing back. And there's more and more people saying, no, free ports aren't the solution, or the trusted trader program doesn't necessarily solve everything, or transit won't fix all your problems. And I think that's something that I'm very happy about. It's that the journalists are picking up on this. There's so many journalists that over the last couple of years have learned so much about customs and trade in general. There's some that have been doing this for 20, 30 years and they really didn't need to learn anything about it. But there are also some that have really, you can see them. I remember 2 years ago, they would call me for the simplest customs stuff. And now they just call for something massively complicated, but they get the basics now themselves without any help. So I think that I'm quite happy about that, that in general, people know more about customs, and there are people that are paying attention to what's being said about the claims that are being made about customs and are ready to push back one way or another.
Thanks, Anna. If anybody wants to ask a question, please do. Maybe if you make a note of it in the chat, so just in case I don't see you raise your hand, so please do that. I wanted to talk a wee bit about the downsides of Twitter, and particularly things like trolling. And Anna, would you be willing to say a wee bit about that?
Look, I'm not only a woman, but I'm also foreign, and I have the wrong kind of accent. In terms of trolling and Twitter, the downsides of Twitter, first of all, if you're a woman and you want to familiarize yourself with trolling, I strongly suggest you change your profile picture, because that's just a fantastic opportunity to have people you've never met and have no idea who they are contact you to tell you whether they think you look hot on that picture. So that's really something that's worthwhile. I think that's definitely something we all struggle with. And I remember getting very, very upset at the beginning. I got a lot of nasty comments, a lot of very personal comments. and I used to get very upset. I still get upset, but it's just part of the game. It's part of the experience. There's nothing you can do about it. I mute people all the time. My general kind of test is if I went to a pub and spoke to you in a pub, would I stay and want to engage in the conversation, or would I walk away? I never mute anyone because they disagree with me or because they tell me I'm wrong. That's fine. That's not a problem. It's just the way they do it. If someone's getting personal, abusive, I don't block people because I don't necessarily think that, you know, they have the right to say whatever they feel or, you know, whatever they want to say, but I don't necessarily need to spend my private time engaging with that. So I mute people, but there's definitely a lot of that. And it's not necessarily proportional. So I do feel like certain people get more of that than others. I don't know Dimitri and David think about it, but I do feel like it's not necessarily proportional.
I could say just something I discovered. When you get new followers, if they look like bots to you, then blocking them immediately has made a big difference in terms of the amount of trolling I get and just some really bizarre, horrible stuff. And I find if I forget to do that for a while, then it's worse. So it's just a wee tip if anybody might find that useful. David or Dimitri, if you want to comment on the downsides, Dimitri?
I mean, first of all, Emma's 1,000% right about the proportionality. I think of the three of us, I have the largest account. I virtually get no trolling. I mean, that's not an invitation, everyone, but I mean, compared to what, like, Anna would get more, she showed me her feed. Other women who have accounts of vaguely comparable size have shown me what their notifications are like, what their DM requests are like. I get almost nothing. It's 100% a gendered thing. There are other elements to it as well, but the gender is like 90% of it a lot of the time. So my experience on Twitter has been very, very different to any woman I know with an account of over like 5 followers. And their experience has been noticeably worse. So that's the problem. I take a slightly different approach to Anna in that, again, maybe because I spend a lot more time on the platform, because it is like almost a job for me. I treat my feed like my own personal mental health safe zone. If you annoy me, I will block and mute you. I have a rule, like I block anyone who replies to my tweets with alternate regional spellings. Like if I tweet whiskey and you like whiskey with an E, my immediate take is like, if that is what you want to share with the world, if that tweet is an accurate representation of what you believe I am interested in, then I never want to hear from you again. And absolutely no one on earth is entitled to my content. I tweet for free. My tweets cost nothing. I'm glad some people find them useful. Absolutely no one is entitled to them. And so I will do what, given how much time I spend on the platform and how much sort of myself is invested in it, I will use every function that Twitter support provides me in order to curate that space into a place that allows me to maintain equilibrium. What I will say about kind of trolling and arguments on Twitter is one thing that I did early that I no longer do is I used to feel like if somebody was arguing with me, then it was my job to keep responding to them, no matter how much they were arguing in bad faith, in circles, or from a position of ignorance. Because I was like, well, what if someone comes along, reads this 65 tweet thread, and sees that they made a point and I didn't respond? Will they think that this person was right all along, and that actually, like, sort of that I have conceded their point by walking away? And that is not remotely how Twitter works. You can check the analytics on a tweet that's 34 tweets down with an account that has 8 people. Nobody but you and this other person is reading it. And it is not your job to correct every single person on the internet. And it is not your job as well to engage with people who broadcast their bad faith. MAGA Patriot hashtag kill the immigrants is not about to be convinced of the value of Mode 4 services trade because you provide them with a good citation or a logically sound argument. They are there to enrage you and they are there to repeat talking points. And it is not your job to fix them, nor is it your job to like signpost their being wrong for anyone who happens to stumble across it. People are perfectly capable of spotting bad faith arguments without you drumming each and every single one of them to death in an endless game of whack-a-mole with people who frankly have more time on their hands than you do. That's my contribution to the world.
Can I just say that spelling whiskey with an E is a blockable offense, even for me?
Drinking the wrong whiskey for Anna is the blockable offense.
I'll block people for that, yeah.
What we're discovering here, I think, is that Dimitri and I are sort of the polar opposites here, is that I get so many comments saying how nice I am on social media. Obviously, they're comparing me to Dimitri, who's, you know, appalling on social media, whereas I'm not really that nice at all. So, you know, I have these, you know, terribly nice engagements with people with completely mad views whatsoever. And I agree, like Dimitri, I've stopped sort of replying to the 37th reply or whatever, but you know, I have these terribly nice engagements, and I've got a handful of people blocked, a handful of accounts muted, which are basically the sort of, you know, just coming up with the same nonsense each time, and just, you know, if you see them, you want to engage, and it's like no, it's not worth it. But most of the time, I'm terribly terribly nice, and I don't know why I'm so nice, actually, but you know, because I say I'm not really in real life, so I suppose it's maybe it's my unsafe zone, Twitter, whereas your safe zone, Dimitri. I don't know, but yeah, I always figure that whatever I get is nothing like as bad as all women with the same number of followers as Anna would get as anything. I have it pretty lucky. So that's just good fortune, really.
Might get a bit of trolling for that T-shirt, David.
Apparently, I'm already getting a bit of trolling. Simon is just there. Yeah.
Actually, talking of Simon, can we bring you in as a real professor?
A real professor, yes. That's
good science. Could you say a wee bit, Simon, because you're famous for your graphics, which neatly summarise where we are on Brexit and complicated issues in one slide, as you're just a master of that. Could you say a wee bit about what brought you to be doing that, and maybe any tips yourself?
It's probably mainly because I couldn't think of anything else useful to do, and it's kind of really echoing what our three panelists are saying, which is, you know, finding something that you think is of value. Having been on Twitter for quite a long time, you know, kind of casting around to find different ways of communicating information. So a lot of it is about thinking about what's useful for different audiences. And yeah, those graphics that I do, and you say that I'm famous for, I'm famous with about six people.
Some of us rely on them, Simon.
But, you know, so it's just, you know, for me, I think also one of the things that's very useful is in trying to explain things to other people, it helps me have to make sense of it for myself. And I know that I think for several of you, you know, I've gone to other people and said, you know, I've done this. Have I got it right? It's usually about islands that I get particularly anxious again, we've already discussed. But yeah, it's really just about trying to do something. And again, having just some point where I'm putting a bit more time into doing something rather than just kind of responding ad hoc. So yeah, you know, for me, I know it took a long time to find a space that I'm comfortable with. And again, just kind of going back to the trolling comments, I've had hardly anything. Occasionally, I like to engage with somebody who I don't particularly know that I'm going to change their mind, but it's a good exercise in just let's try and have a discussion. So yes, the ones who are completely out of kilter, there's no point. But you know, sometimes somebody will come with a critical comment. You know, this morning I've done a little graphic, and then I've got people saying, well, you know, this demonstrates X, Y, and Z. And again, lots of people attributing views to me about what I think about Brexit or anything else. And so actually just sometimes it's good once in a while just to kind of have a practice of that kind of mode. That's maybe a more academic kind of trait than a professional one. But yeah, it's, you know, it's useful, and I think that's really, you know, where it's come from.
Thanks, Simon. I think I don't have any questions coming through, and I think just to sort of begin to wrap up, I guess the question would be, do you think you'd be more or less productive if you spent less time on Twitter? David?
Well, productive? Yes, I could write more boring reports that not many people would read. So this idea, I think academics have it, I'm not sure think tankers have it, about impact. I could write lots more. So in theory, I could be productive. But actually, Twitter is part of what I do. It's the explanation part. There are days, and I won't lie, this morning was one of them, where it does feel you're not getting anything done because you know, on a heavy news morning on your subject, it can be hard to lift yourself away from Twitter. And I had other work to do this morning, so that wasn't good. But most of the time, I think it's part of the same kind of productivity. It is kind of hard to measure. I mean, I think as well, you know, I was thinking before about what are the audiences on Twitter. A lot of the people I meet, whether they are officials who can't really say anything else, or businesses also feel they can't really talk. A lot of people are quite actually encouraging to say, no, please do tweet, because you're tweeting on behalf of a number of people who can't say anything. So again, I think that's part of the productivity. So no, I would count Twitter as part of a large part of what I do, but sometimes it's too large a part. And you know, I have been trying, certainly, you know, summer's always a good time to do this, when actually I haven't been going on for a few hours while I've been finishing off work. I would never have got away with that this morning, but other times I can get away with it. And what if I'd have missed Simon's picture this morning? I mean, it's such a good picture, and you know, I miss it, and you know, I've missed everything. Only just caught Peter Foster's, you know, latest blockbuster exclusive last night. And so suddenly, you know, if you're in the sort of commentary or think tank business, and you suddenly these things are happening, you do feel there's a, you know, you don't want to miss too many of them. Yeah, everybody misses a few, but if you miss too many, it's almost like you're not there anymore.
Thank you, David. I'll ask the same question to Anna.
Well, I think by this definition, I'm very clearly not on Twitter, by David's definition. For me, Twitter is a distraction from what I actually do, which is client work. I enjoy being on Twitter, and very often I have this dilemma, and that's why I think about it so much, is because, you know, a couple hours go by and I realize all I've done today, was to tweet and exchange gifts with Dimitri or read one of David's longer threads, but I actually needed to do something else. So Twitter is fun, it's engaging, it's a fantastic way to, you know, one place where you can see what everyone else is thinking. So you have a story breaking, and then you have everyone else's take, and it's fascinating for me to see, because everyone, even if they are in principle agree, everyone's bringing a slightly different angle, a slightly different point to the conversation. So I like being on Twitter and checking what everyone's thinking, but equally, no, there's no chance I can be on Twitter as much as David. Just not gonna happen between now and December, given how much work I said yes to in the recent weeks. I think tweeting is gonna come out of my either sleep or meal time, I'm not entirely sure, but I do try to be on Twitter every day, but yeah, no, that's, I have way too much work to be able to do it. It's a shame, because I miss a lot. I do have to say, I miss a lot. And sometimes I'm way too busy. Like last night, I see a story breaking and all I can tweet is one sentence, because I just have to go back to work. Otherwise I'm not going to sleep. It's a shame, but again, I very much enjoy what I do, so I wouldn't trade it. But yeah.
Thanks, Anna. Dimitri.
I'm in a slightly different boat, I guess, to my far more credentialed, qualified counterparts on this panel, in that the only reason I have a consultancy that literally anybody is willing to give money to is because of Twitter. I got my first gig training the United Kingdom's negotiators back in like late 2018 because of Twitter. 90% of my clients over the last 2 years, probably 95%, have come from Twitter or from because they saw my name in, you know, the New York Times or something. And the reason they saw my name in the New York Times is because I'm on Twitter. Like, or that somebody recommended somebody, but the reason that person recommended it is because I'm on Twitter. So for me, who left the Australian Civil Service, I was a second secretary in Geneva. I was a comparatively junior ranked Australian civil servant back in Capital. The fact that I am occasionally mentioned in the same breath as people like Anna is entirely a function of Twitter. And so to that extent, while on any given task in a day, it definitely hurts my productivity. If I'm trying to write an article or a paper, then Twitter is definitely distracting. On the other hand, it's the reason anybody asked me to write the article in the first place. So it's kind of part of the equation. You just kind of take it for what it is, and you try to basically put your phone on flight mode when you really do need to crack out that last 600 words before crunch time.
Great, thanks, Dimitri. So we have two questions before we close. The first one is from Peter Holmes. Peter?
Right, well, really great panel. I interact on Twitter quite a bit with these great guys. We're not quite in the same league. And it's really nice. I think one can say that Trade Twitter is actually a community. But what I find is that when I tell colleagues and friends who are not necessarily academics that I spend quite a lot of time on Twitter, they'll say, oh, well, no, we don't like Twitter. You get lots of fake news and there's all this acrimony. What would you say to people who say they really want to, they sort of don't fear going on Twitter?
Thanks, Peter. Who'd like to take that question, David?
You should tell them to follow you, Peter. I've never seen you post any fake news. And I think all serious bit is, yeah, it's right. It's a, you know, it can be a terrible, appalling site. So don't follow any of the bit. I mean, I do find that really odd, actually. When I hear this quite a lot. Oh my God, it's so terrible. I see so many bad things on Twitter. Well, why are you following them then? I don't see that many bad things on Twitter, mainly because I didn't follow any of the people who spread lots of bad things on Twitter. I mean, all right, I see some things that I don't really want to know about Dimitri's Dungeons and Dragons or whatever it is. I'll just about put up with that because most of his content's good. I get jealous with Anna's hiking pictures. But, you know, yeah, don't follow them. I'm not sure. I must be missing something somewhere along the line because I see a remarkably little amount of really disturbing hell site false news, etc. From the people I follow. Maybe I must be following the wrong people, or perhaps I think the right people.
Anna?
I guess for me, you know, as much as I mentioned this, you know, I struggle in terms of spending time on Twitter, but the reason that I keep coming back to Twitter and the reason that I want to continue being on Twitter is the sense of community. Not only, you know, it is at the end of the day, it's a social media platform. Not only am I able to stay in touch with people that are all over Europe and all over the world, but and get to know what they're thinking on any given story. I'm not necessarily going to have time or not going to bother Dimitri or David WhatsApping them asking, oh, what do you think about what happened yesterday? But I can see it on Twitter, and you know, that's, and I actually do, I spend more time reading than I spend tweeting, just seeing what everyone else thinks. So that's one aspect. And then you get to meet so many incredible people in your field. There's so many people that I know that I would never have met, you know, if I wasn't on Twitter. So I don't see this. I personally, I was very kind of reluctant to join Twitter just because I didn't thought I'm going to have enough time. And that was true. But, you know, it's in many ways a fantastic opportunity. And also, I don't remember last time when I actually got news from any news outlet. You get news from Twitter. That's quicker than anything else. All the major journals, everyone's on Twitter. And even, you know, last night the news broke on Twitter. It was somewhere else later on, but that's how you find out about things. How do you find out about things without Twitter?
Good point. Dimitri, did you want to answer this question?
Yeah, I mean, I think Pete raises kind of a two-part thing, the acrimony and the fake news. On the acrimony, look, Twitter's a public square. And once you get up on the soapbox, you kind of accept that some people are going to listen to you, some people are going to engage with you, and some people are going to throw tomatoes. And that's unfortunate, but it is the price of any public engagement. You know, you read the comments under a Telegraph article by somebody, they are 15 times nastier than anything you get on Twitter, and that person merely contributed an article to the Telegraph. That wasn't, they didn't enter that space. I think if you are going to engage in public policy and trying to inform or shape it, some bad stuff's going to come your way. And Twitter can be worse because it does effectively reward savagery, frankly. You want to have a tweet do four times as well. Begin it by throwing an elbow at a public figure. It'll do great every single time. Not necessarily with the people you wanted to do well with, but it'll do great. So there is a bit of that, but it is the price you pay for relevance, effectively, in a lot of ways. And that's not confined to Twitter. The same is true of any public appearance. On the fake news part, this is something I think about a lot. I look at how much modern content, especially from think tanks that maybe don't necessarily operate in the best faith, is basically designed around the idea that nobody reads the article. You look at how much stuff is out there to generate a headline that itself generates a social media thumbnail that goes out there. If you stay off social media as an expert in your field, that is entirely your right, but you are not lessening the amount of fake news in the universe. You're lessening the amount of pushback to fake news. Now, that's not an indictment of you. It is absolutely no one's obligation to wage a crusade against garbage. But it is something to be aware of, that if you're in the public square and you see fake news and you're in a position to credibly call it out, being there lets you do that. And not being there means that fake news just gets retweeted 15,000 times and there's no counter narrative. So that's what I guess what I would say to Peter's friends who are a little bit reticent. But on the other hand, I mean, look, it's rough. It's social media. God.
Thanks, guys. Excellent answers. And now we have a real peach of a question to conclude the panel from Simon.
I guess my peach of a question should be, why did you ever accept to do this? But I'm very grateful that you did. I'd like to say thank you to all four of you for doing the work for me so I can tweet comments about you. My question actually is that whilst David's desire that nothing should happen in the past hour and a half has been granted, could you just give one piece of advice to the negotiators in the future relationship talks that are going on between the UK and the EU? I leave it to you to decide which negotiators you direct that to and what it involves. Some thoughts or a thought that you think might help. Tumbleweed.
I'm happy to start because I have the least to contribute. Well, first of all, I was strongly encouraging them to consider the services of a negotiating consultancy like Explain Trade, but more seriously, which is actually just general advice for everyone on earth, everyone should hire me. But failing that, I think my my advice would be twofold. There are plenty of other actors in your systems that can drum up the domestic base. It is weird how much both David Frost and Michel Barnier have taken it upon themselves to be the drum beaters for the domestic hardliners. And I feel like, I'm not second guessing that judgment, but I feel like that work is done now. And perhaps it is maybe time to curtail the after every round press conference where they call the other side all sorts of names, because no matter how professional these two men are and no matter how much they get that the other side has a domestic constituency they're playing to, my sense is that can't help but bleed into the room at least a little. And everybody at home who is convincible that the EU is asking for something unprecedented or that the UK is cherry-picking the single market is by this point convinced. So I would kind of offer that advice. And my second advice, which is absolutely sort of obvious, is the leaders need to get into a room. There's absolutely no substitute for it. The mandates are clearly mutually exclusive. This has been obvious for 6 months. And continuing to butt heads against each other in a technical room without Boris Johnson and the EU leaders working out a compromise, at least on state aid, it is just burning the clock down. There's just no substitute for it.
Thank you, Dimitri. Anna?
I guess, again, two pieces of advice. I don't know if it's advice. I'm perhaps really naive. I still hope, maybe not as much as believe, but hope that both sides, and I perhaps believe that about one side more than the other, that both sides kind of understand and are aware of the kind of two-level game, the fact that what's said in the press, in the kind of public eye, is on the political level is one kind of conversation, and that conversation for a very obvious reason is very polarized. It's very, you know, it's a game. It's a negotiating tactic. But underneath that, on the kind of civil servants kind of actual talks level, I still hope that there is enough reason to know that, let's just say, for example, breaking an international treaty that you signed is not a good idea. And I think my advice would be just don't get these two levels too far from each other. You do still need to come back from whatever you're putting out there in the media. I appreciate you need to sell on both sides the deal that I still believe is going to happen as a success. And you still need to kind of show how you've contributed to it and how you've conquered all the obstacles to achieve that incredible deal before anyone starts actually reading what's in that deal and how we're actually going to implement it. But just be careful of how high the stakes are. That's one advice. And the other one would be just, it's not just about the next election. It's about also the next 10 years, 5 years, 20 years. I feel like it's a very short-sighted perspective that politicians have for obvious reasons, but the effects of whatever happens obviously will be long-term. So be mindful of that.
Thank you, Anna. Wise words. David.
And I think that would lead into what I was thinking, that not to overlap. So what I would be thinking differently is, look, the time horizon is bonkers here. You are basically, you know, you're coming out of a major divorce in January, and you want your entire future to be resolved by October. Can't happen. You're actually literally trying to, you know, you're just trying to sort of lay out your entire future before you've got a chance to know what it is. Therefore, were there to be any scope for this, I've no idea if there is, I've no idea if either side is talking about it, and I know why neither would want to, is to look for those, you know, the interim solutions, the temporary solutions, the things you can fudge a bit for later. I know exactly, you know, neither side wants to do this, but neither side, and this is where I get accused, oh, you're being too unfair to the EU and too fair to the UK side. But the EU doesn't actually know what they really want over the next 10 years, but they've got a better idea than the UK does. But neither side really know what they want. So, you know, should we go on, neither side actually really knows what they want. We've given ourselves a timescale that's unrealistic. you're just going to have to find ways to play with that timescale. So that would be my advice. Apart from obviously hire Dimitri, hire Anna. That obviously would be the case. And by the way, just as we're finishing, can I say thanks to Katie for actually chairing this. So well, the only person on the panel who actually has an award for her successful tweeting. And she's been getting us to talk about that, and she has the award.
Thanks, David. May I thank you all for being very well behaved, not causing any trouble, and for giving really brilliant answers to questions that range far and wide. So thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure, and I've really enjoyed the conversation. And thank you to Simon, for whose idea it was in the first place. And thanks to you, Aces. And I look forward to seeing you in real life, maybe.
Thanks so much, Katie.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks,
thank you both. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.
Thanks so much. Bye.